Hey everybody, welcome to the Pratfalls Podcast. This episode is my conversation with Chuck Hermes, or Hermes, depending. You'll hear more about the name pronunciation in our conversation. I wanted to first mention I connected with Chuck through a number of ways, but I got to have a conversation with him at Giant Steps, which is an annual conference in Minneapolis. It is where I've met a lot of awesome folks who've been on this podcast and in my life. So I just wanted to highlight that. Check out Giant Steps if you are in Minnesota or going to be in Minnesota. It is one of my favorite things that exists in the world. I also want to plug another podcast that I've got out in the world called Not About You, about identity, about social justice. I hope you've given it a listen. If not, go check it out. You can go look for Not About You on any of your podcast apps or naypod.com. It'll take you there as well. Of course, you can rate and review this show in iTunes. That helps more people find it. It makes me feel invigorated about my work as a creative person. Enough about that. I'm just going to get right into it. So why don't we cut to the chase? Here is my conversation with Chuck. So you're Chuck Hermes? Is it Hermes?
Yeah.
The elf on Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer?
Yes. Hermes.
Hermes.
Even when I tell people that, like whenever I've done talks here or there or whatever, I tell them how to pronounce my last name, and then they always seem to introduce me as Chuck Hermes something like that.
Because that's a designer, right?
That's the French. Yeah. Makes the expensive scarves.
Yeah. Are you French and fancy? Do you
know
the origins?
Actually, well, the true story is that my last name is pronounced Hermes. It's German. And so my great-grandparents immigrated to the U.S. They settled in North Dakota, and they were Hermes. And my dad went to college and ended up getting a teaching job in Minnesota, and everybody said Hermes. And he corrected them by saying Hermes, and they said Hermes and Hermes and Hermes. And so, you know, the end of the story here.
Yeah.
Finally, he just tossed up his hands and said, all right, we're Hermes. And so all my cousins are still Hermes, but we're Hermes.
Oh, that's so strange. Mm-hmm. So you don't even have the same pronunciation as family members.
No, and they think it's really funny.
Yeah.
And we kind of sold out.
Well, language is living, breathing. I mean, it's hard to fight that fight.
Right,
if
right.
no one's going to call you that anymore.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's sort of, everybody's names. There's a transition when you come to Ellis Island, right?
Yeah.
And you get a new name. So coming to Fergus Falls, Minnesota, I guess we got assigned a new pronunciation.
It's like Ellis Island. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's the same idea.
Yeah, right.
More desolate.
Fergus Falls is the Ellis Island of
the
Minnesota.
Upper Midwest. That's beautiful. They should. They need something. Some kind of...
A tagline.
Travel slogan.
That's
so
right.
Come
tourism.
See.
Come and get a new pronunciation of your last name.
Give us your, I don't know what the, we'll have to work out what the sign will say, because it's not quite the same.
Yeah, but then we can go up and pitch them on this. We can go to the Chamber of Commerce or whatever you would do up
I think
in
it's
Fergus
a million-dollar idea.
That sounds brilliant.
We'll put some, you're a graphic designer.
Yeah, yeah.
So there, yeah, I want to know about that. Well, I have, I know you are, you're at Clockwork,
mm-hmm.
and is your title a Chief Experience Officer?
Yeah.
Is that what it is?
Yep.
And so I would like to have you tell me what that means, because that can mean any number of things.
Right.
But just sort of looking at your background, I know you started as a visually thinking designer, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And sort of that transitioned itself into the sort of the user experience in general of technology. Is that is that true? Like how people do things and what.
Yeah, and I think the whole psychology of design is what... Are we rolling now?
We
is
are.
This happening?
We're rolling. You can tell because you
don't
asked.
See this, I don't see the tape.
That's the reel. I have a whole room where that is.
Okay, all right. Yeah, I saw the mobile truck pull up out there.
You work in tech, so you should know. Everything is tiny and invisible now.
True.
So, yeah. You should assume you're being recorded all the time.
Yeah.
Also.
Well, I mean, we all are.
That's true.
Right?
True.
Yeah. All right. What was the question?
I want to know more about. Now I have a bunch of espionage questions. what is Chief Experience Officer? What does that mean?
Chief Experience Officer.
And what does it actually mean? What would it mean if you'd say, this is my job? And then, what does your day actually look like?
Yeah. I mean, when I first kind of came up with this title, it was a head scratcher for most people because they didn't really understand what that meant. I think that over the last few years, the word experience is starting to get diluted a bit, or people understand what experience means with technology and user experience. But my background way back goes started in traditional graphic design. And even when I was in high school, we had this fantastic graphic arts department in my high school, and this teacher, Mike Lucy, was just my hero and mentor back then. So I learned how to run printing presses and shoot films and do, this is, you know, 1980s, so we were still doing key lining with tape and typesetting on a machine that we would have to paste onto paperboard and stuff. So I had a really thorough kind of background in graphic design production. And then I got distracted by music for a number of years. And when the Macintosh computer became available and there were all these design tools, I kind of realized that this is really my calling, graphic design. And so I worked just doing kind of freelance design work for a few years, kind of learning design, and spent a little bit of time at MCAD and ended up at Paisley Park and doing graphic design work out there. And then after that, this is kind of the truncated version of this story. There's some interesting bits in there.
Please keep any interesting stuff out.
Just right. We'll put that in the, that can be in the liner notes the album.
Yeah.
After Paisley Park, mid-90s, I started experimenting, or it was while at Paisley Park, I started experimenting with one of our business partners here, Michael Koppelman, with online networks. And this was pre-web, you know, early 90s. We were using these command line interfaces to just communicate and doing bulletin boards. That was all text-based stuff, but it was fascinating. And we found some software that we could build upon and create a graphic user interface for this bulletin board software that we were using, and we created this thing called Bitstream Underground. Mm-hmm. And that was my transition from traditional print-based design to electronic media
design. You took the skills of those visuals to the tech space
And
made it so something looked more approachable and usable.
Yeah. So then to get back to your original question, then, you know, working as a designer in interface design for years with Bitstream and then starting Clockwork, again, visual design and user experience was information architecture was a discipline that was starting to emerge then too. So my personal interest went from graphic design, visual design to the actual like architecture and planning design, wireframes and blueprinty, you know, work. And this was very early on. I mean, we were kind of making it up as we went back then because there wasn't that discipline. And then from there, at, you know, over the years at Clockwork, we've brought in new designers and new UX people that are much, much better at that work than I am. And so, you know, I led those groups for years. And but now what user experience means to us at Clockwork and to me, or the chief experience officer title anyway, means everything from customer experience and the experience of you if you were a Clockwork client to the experience of the employees and the people that work here and just overall like the experience of Clockwork. So that also includes a bit of the work product itself, but is more about customer experience, employee experience.
Yeah.
And then also marketing is rolled in under my umbrella too. So that's where most of my time is spent now, is in the marketing efforts for our business itself.
Yeah. Well, even the relationship your employees and your clients have with this place seems central to marketing. Like those are your advocates for what you're doing.
And well, our promise here is that you'll love working with us. You know, that sounds kind of corny, but it's the truth. So that promise is made both to our clients and to our employees.
Yeah.
You know, and my gauge of success here is like, how do I feel on Sunday nights and Monday mornings? You know, we have this Monday morning test. And I look forward to Monday mornings. And I know a lot of people that do not look forward to Monday mornings. So, and I think, you know, if I walk around and ask people and just do a check of the barometer on Monday mornings, that's it. You're like, do you like it here? Great. Then we're doing our job.
Do you think there's anything to maybe you just hire a staff of people who hate their home lives? Like they just can't.
Right.
Like if you tell your wife or kids, I love Monday mornings, they're like, yeah, we know what that means.
Well, I do have to temper that message sometimes.
Yeah.
Because it's like TGIM.
Yeah.
But my wife and I joked about that because we've got three daughters, and when they were younger especially, it was like, oh my God. I'd come in on Monday mornings just to relax.
Yeah.
Because it was, as any parent knows, like it's just utter chaos at home, but it's manageable chaos at work.
Yeah.
So yeah, coming to work on Mondays was like, thank God the weekend is over. I like can have some peace and quiet.
Well, I feel like at work, everyone is focused on things running normally. Like that's everyone's goal. And at home, it seems like almost no one's on board with that plan.
Right.
Like
right.
that we could just, we had a plan and then that's what we're going to try and do. And
right.
like, no, we each have our separate plans that conflict and contrast.
Well, I just think, Levi, we just sat down and had some food together, and you didn't throw anything or throw a fit or refuse to eat anything.
It was hard, but I didn't, Society's ground that out of me, that instinct.
Yeah.
I can get attention other ways. Well, you glossing through your story does raise a number of, to me, fascinating questions. Mm-hmm. One of the things I think you reveal in there, if you listen, and also just I've heard you speak a few times, and I know a little, I know some of the people you know, so I don't know you well, but I know some of your colleagues, is there's this vein of music running through your life. You're on the board of an organization that is involved with independent artists. Mm-hmm. You've spent a lot of time at Paisley Park. That is not a place I think you can be if you don't have an affinity for music. I don't think no matter what your job is, you should also love music, or why would you be there? Uh-huh. And there is an interesting sort of cross relationship. I don't know what it's like now, but I know in the 80s and early 90s, designers were often overlapping with like rock and punk circles as like makers of posters and makers of cool, weird outsider art.
Yeah.
So I'm curious how you fit into that. Like, where does music fit into your life? And are you a musician? Or is that a thing you have pursued as well? And what is it? How does that interact with the way you think about your this experience? Because that's the same idea.
How
are you experiencing this thing?
Music has been a huge part of my life. I'm the youngest of six kids, and my two older brothers were hardcore Rolling Stones fans. You know, and I was born in the late '60s. You know, and like that was the Stones era. So. They joke that I said, you know, knew Mick Jagger's name before I knew my own name, really. But so their influence on me just as a fan of music was huge, which then led into the, like, you know, the tennis racket in front of the mirror stuff when I was a kid.
I was really good at guitar at that phase.
Which then led into my brother and I getting a guitar and a bass and putting a band together, you know, when we were in junior high. Which then led to the pursuit of, like, we're going to do this, man. We're going to write original songs, and we're going to get out there, and we're going to be the Rolling Stones, right? And so that's what I said earlier when I got distracted by music for a number of years. I was always very creative visually and artistically, like, through illustration. And, you know, I've got funny pictures of winning the Christmas illustration competition in Fergus Falls for the post office in third grade.
Awesome.
So I love that stuff, and that was really, I got a lot of attention for that, which of course I loved. So that was always there, like I loved that piece. But then music was more exciting, and we had this band, and we moved to Minneapolis and spent a number of years doing that. But I remember when I was kind of getting burnt out on, or realizing that, man, you know, I'm not really comfortable being up on stage, and this isn't really my thing, you know. And what I've kind of realized that I was equally drawn to, or if not, maybe even more drawn to the artwork that was related to music, like you're describing, you know, all of the, even like the image of bands and the marketing of bands and the posters and the artwork on the CDs or albums or whatever it was at that time, you know, was really fascinating to me. And I remember being, there was down in Loring Park, I worked as a courier, so I'm driving all over the metro, and I stopped into, I think the coffee shop was called Cafte, and it was on Loring Park where Dunn Brothers is now. And I walked in, and I was standing in line, and I looked and saw all these posters around, and then I saw the coffee cups, and I saw, you know, the signs on the walls, and I saw the magazines and the newspapers, and like, it was like my mind just opened up to design. Like, everything is designed. There's design that's an element of everything I see right now. And that was the moment for me that was like, that's the path I need to take.
That's like a scene from Usual Suspects. I mean, like, puts it all together.
It really was. I mean, it was like everything else blurred out.
Yeah.
And these letters and shapes and forms all just kind of like emerged to like go bonk right in the forehead.
That is unusual. I was at some talk, and there was a person doing a brief presentation about door handles, uh-huh. and talking about how frustrating they found the wrong door handle on when it's a push or a pull, simple stuff. But when she first started talking about the people who make these, mm-hmm. I noticed the audience audibly react to the idea that someone thought of, like, that there was a designer behind, like, we have all these things we just take for granted, uh-huh. like, that's just where windows go.
Yeah.
Like, no one is like, no, someone had to decide that. Uh-huh. So I wonder if you felt, did that make you feel unusual that you suddenly had this, oh, someone made a decision about everything around me?
Yeah. It was, man, I felt like I just got lifted off the ground because truly, like, thinking about doorknobs.
Yeah.
You know, the design of a doorknob. And you notice things when they don't work properly.
Yes.
You don't notice them when they do.
Yeah.
And so those things, and this even like gets into the type of work we do at Clockwork now, where like we're not really ever pursuing the really sexy kind of work. We like the stuff that is sort of the, like, I'm not going to say basic, but behind the scenes, you know, like we just love to fix problems. Mm-hmm. And that's what design was for me then too, of realizing like I can look anywhere and think about how could I improve like this chair we're sitting in, or how could I improve the visual layout of this poster so that the message is delivered more effectively. That just blew my mind thinking about that.
Yeah. And so does that still feel like a creative practice? Does that to you feel like highly creative, that you're problem solving with creative ideas? Is that what that is?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that, like, to this day, you know, I notice the little things that, I mean, you know, most people maybe don't notice. And I'm not irritated by them, but it's just fascinating to think, how could you improve? You know, look at that cabinet there, that door is broken. It could be fixed very simply, a little design.
Yeah.
You know, change could fix that. You know, it's fascinating.
But you say you're that, how come that doesn't frustrate you like that? I feel like part of why we don't notice is because it could become obnoxious to just see, like, nothing works quite right. This could all be better. Like, that feels like a path to madness.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I'm just an optimist.
Why is it exciting? Is that it? I mean, is it instinctive? Did you have to?
I just look at things as like a challenge, you know, or it's interesting to think about. It gives me something to think about.
Yeah, yeah.
Otherwise, my mind would be totally blank.
Just nothing?
Yeah.
That's your only option. Uh-huh. You're looking for a delightful problem to solve. Otherwise, it's just like a tumbleweed flying across.
At most, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then I would love to know, like, how could we fix the tumbleweed?
Right,
is that
right.
The most efficient way?
Right. How could the tumbleweed make its way across this street quicker?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great problem to solve.
Yeah.
Not pointless at all. What happened that, I mean, I could be wrong, but I don't know that you're a world famous musician now.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened that you stopped? I know that's not an unlikely thing for anyone.
Yeah.
Not to stifle anyone's dreams, but was there a shift there of, oh, I'm passionate about this thing and it is a viable job? Or was it, I mean, what did you feel, did you pull back on the music ambition?
How did I make that transition?
Yeah.
At about the same time as I had that, you know, life-changing experience at Cafe Coffee, I was in this band. Been doing it for a couple of years, and we had done the East Coast, you know, like, I got to play CBGBs. That was it, you know.
Nice.
So we kind of did that stuff. But I think I realized I was maybe 20, 21 at this time, and I just felt like I needed to do something else. So I put in notice with this band, and we had studio time booked out at Paisley Park. And so when I called to cancel the studio time, I just said, you wouldn't happen to have any jobs open, would you? And the studio manager that I was talking to said, you know what, I think we do, you know what.
Did you already know the studio manager a little bit?
No, not at all.
Just a cold, like...
Just some guy from some band.
Yeah. You know, calling him.
Anyway, I went out and had an interview and took a job as a night receptionist at Paisley Park. And there was a decision there, too. I was working this courier job, and I got paid hourly plus mileage. And, you know, for what I was doing, I was making a fairly good amount of money for a single 20-year-old guy, whatever. And so it was taking a pay cut to go be the night receptionist at Paisley Park. And I'm glad I took the risk. Because there really was a moment like, should I do this?
Yeah.
But what happened out there then was I was still interested in playing music and pursuing music, but I was also exposed to the production side of music and engineering. So then I thought, well, I can still look for other band opportunities and stuff, but I can also like dip my toe into this engineering thing because I have access to all this stuff and all these people. But then over about a year as I was night receptionist, I've decided that I'm going to enroll at MCAD. So then I thought, I can work this job at night, I can go to school in the day, it's perfect. And as I got involved in my schoolwork, Prince started to take notice of stuff that I was doing up at the front desk, you know, for these hours and hours where there was
nothing to do. You mean design stuff?
Yeah, yeah.
Not random stunts you were
playing. Right. And then other people at Paisley kind of noticed and were like, hey, we need this flyer, we need this thing, we need this. So I started doing little design tasks like that. And there were other, like, freelance people. There wasn't an art department out there, but there were other visual creative people that were coming and going for various projects and stuff. So then I started to, like, hang out with those people. And anyway, to shorten the story, at one point...
You don't have to shorten any stories either.
All right.
I mean, you can.
You can edit.
Yeah, I can.
Edit these down.
Yeah.
After,
if you're talking about Prince stories, rarely is anyone like, can you just wrap this up? Like it's...
Right. So I ended up taking a different job at Paisley Park than that was with Paisley Park Records. So I moved from the front desk. This was, you know, a little less than a year from when I started to working with this woman, Therese Stolo, who was basically Prince's right hand at that time, and we were working on all the album stuff. So my job was to do kind of production coordination for the Prince records that were coming out at that time. So that was, you know, right at the end of Batman had just wrapped, Graffiti Bridge was going on, that went into Diamonds and Pearls and records that came after that. But my job was to like go, it was great, I would go into the studio at night or in the day in this case because Prince liked to work at night. And the engineers would set me up, and I would isolate vocal tracks and write down the lyrics and then go key them into the computer and then, you know, do a little bit of typesetting and work between Warner Brothers Records and Paisley Park Records on putting together those packages. So it was very much like base-level graphic production work.
Right.
But on Prince records.
Yeah, with amazing music and lyrics.
Right.
Yeah.
And being able to go in the studio and like go, I wonder what this song would sound like if it was just guitar, bass, drums, and Prince's vocal. Like, who gets to do that? You know?
Yeah.
So, that was great. And then from there, one day Prince, I was working on some dumb little project of some sort, and he said, so, you're going to school for this? I said, yeah. He said, it costs a lot of money to go to school for this? And I said, yeah. Because back at that time, you know, 1990, it was $12,000 a year or something, which was astronomical kind of, you know, for art school. And he said, yeah, it costs a lot of money to go to school for this? And I said, yeah. And he said, why don't you just do this here? And next thing I knew, you know, he basically, and the management out there just said, build an art department out here. So here's a guy with really zero experience, less than a year of school, you know, tasked with building an in-house art department at Paisley Park. So I, you know, found some people.
Yeah, I mean, what was that moment? Like, did you feel immediately in over your head? Were you aware of that?
I was terrified.
And what did you do with that terror?
So the management people out there were really great.
Yeah.
And Therese was really great. All these people that, in you know, working in that environment was chaotic and crazy, as everybody's heard. So the staff was really supportive of each other because you never knew what you're going to be thrown into.
And open to risk, it sounds like.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So I just got a lot of encouragement and ideas of like, you know, we've worked with this art director and this creative director for this project and that project. And so I reached out to some of these people and then eventually connected with this art director, Jeff Munson, who was living down in Chicago or Rockford, Illinois. And he had been working on the Graffiti Bridge projects as a freelancer. He had been doing a bunch of Paisley stuff years before. And we connected and seemed to hit it off pretty well. And it didn't take much to twist his arm to say, do you want to come up here and lead this art department?
Yeah.
You know, I'm in charge of setting it up, but you're the guy with the experience. So will you come up
here? That's smart of you. I mean, I could see someone thinking I should be the one who makes all the decisions and then sort of hamstringing themselves when all their inexperience came through.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, I couldn't try and fake that.
Did you feel like you had a self-awareness about that? I mean, that your ego wasn't so dominant.
Like, I have no ego.
Well, you just crumbled and turned into dust.
No, I think, you know, my insecurity, I think, served me well at that time. You know, I didn't want to blow this opportunity.
Yeah.
So I just thought, I need a mentor.
Yeah.
And, you know, Jeff ended up being that person at that time. And it was a lot of fun.
That's impressive. Even if it came from a place of sort of accurate, maybe, insecurity, mm-hmm. that I think we often view insecurity as a negative thing.
Like, yeah.
But it's often telling you something.
Uh-huh.
That, hey, the thing you're insecure about, maybe you don't, like, you're not a doctor, so don't do surgery right now.
Right, right.
Like,
yeah.
I feel like there's this idea of, like, do-it-yourself individualism in the U.S.
Yeah.
That tells you to, like, just fake it till you make it.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that's great. I mean, especially from a creative standpoint, you do have to sort of get slightly in over your head and see if you can learn.
Right.
But it can really ruin you, too. And it sounds like you have really good relationships there that you could have totally damaged.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
By just being like, oh, it's a month in and I've ruined several projects.
Yeah.
Do you feel like how has that experience informed the way you now like manage and lead other people? And because you were given a lot of room then and a lot of free rein without a ton of direction, maybe.
Right. Our job really was just to have something colorful and cool sitting on Prince's desk every morning when he came in. And truly, I mean, that.
Yeah. Kind of,
and so there were all these projects and things, and you know, we would spend hours together working on these things, but the latitude we were given was enormous.
Yeah.
So I think, like, you know, one of my insecurities now in this business is that, like, I didn't get a college degree, you know. But it's funny, my wife mentioned when Prince died this past spring, she called me that afternoon and said, how do you feel about this? And it's been 23 years since I last walked out the door there. And at first I thought, this isn't part of my life. It hasn't been in almost a quarter century, so this shouldn't have a great effect on me. But then as the day wore on, the impact kind of hit harder. And as we were talking that night, she said, you know what? That's the thing. Like, Paisley Park was kind of your college.
Yeah.
You know, that's where you went to college. And with all of those people, those are your college buddies. And you had your crazy times at college was out there. So that's why it had such a great impact. Yeah. And I think, you know, thinking about, like, as you mentioned, the latitude we had there and the ability to explore and experiment, that's what he wanted. You know, he didn't want us to take direction and just stick with that direction. It was like, bring stuff to me. You know, he wanted to see what was cool. He wanted to know what was out there going on. And there was encouragement to always push the boundaries. So I think that, you know, leading into where we are now, and even just the culture of this place, I think is very similar in a way. And Bitstream, too, we're very similar in a way, because the core people that built the first business, Bitstream, were all Paisley Park expatriates. And then a few of them moved into Clockwork as well. So the culture just was built on the types of personalities that I think partly were the type of people that were able to, attracted to get jobs out there and work in that environment, but then also like translate that kind of same culture feel into our business. You know, I'm maybe not making sense.
No, but I think you are.
Yeah, I think it really was sort of born out of that experience is what was the seed of the culture of this place. And I think it's the same thing here now with us and with Nancy especially. She's always encouraging people to push the boundaries and you know, the old statement of don't ask for permission, ask for forgiveness if necessary.
Yeah. Well, it's really strange, but just from what I know of Nancy Lyons, your sort of really close colleague, mm-hmm. there's a lot of prints there. Like, mm-hmm. she has full confidence in her abilities. Uh-huh. And it gets to be her full self in pretty much every space I've ever seen her in.
Yeah.
But also is mostly not making it about her. Uh-huh. And I think that was a distinctive piece of sort of at least the performative part of Prince. Where uh-huh. like certainly there were moments where it was fundamentally about him.
Yeah.
But it was different. It was a connection thing. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't make that, you know, like on paper. I don't know if Nancy and Prince looked super similar. Uh-huh.
But pretty much.
Yeah. But I can see the cultural through line that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And even that feeling of sort of walking into clockwork where you feel like things are taken care of, uh-huh. but also like no one's going to yell at you if you sit in the wrong chair or something, which is not true in some offices. Uh-huh.
I think the greatest thing is like knowing from that experience too is that he was following his gut, mm-hmm. and everyone had to kind of to some degree trust that and go along, but we also learned to follow our own gut instincts there too.
Yeah.
And that's the way this business runs, you know. We do things if they feel right and we don't if they don't, and we're surrounded by like-minded people, and you know, we have this one of our goals way back and when we first started the business was we had two things in mind, and that's to do great work and have great lives, you know, in that order.
Yeah.
In order to have great lives,
first,
you have to do the great work.
Yeah.
And that's just the basic thing here of like, if it doesn't feel right, let's talk about it. And if it does feel right, let's go for it. Hmm. And that is part of the work we do and the work we pursue and the way we go about the work that we do. And also, you know, ends up, you know, as a sum of a great lives, hopefully.
Yeah. Certainly with Clockwork, Clockwork has this thing of being pretty successful as a business, mm-hmm. but not super flashy. Like, I mean, you talk to, like, you guys, you're totally fine with making the best possible doorknobs. Like,
yeah.
That is totally your
uh-huh.
jam.
Yeah.
And I see, like, a fly under the radar thing of some of the things you've talked about. Like, even you were working with Paisley and with Prince, mm-hmm. and that's like huge on the radar, but mm-hmm. you were doing the parts of like, this is the stuff that sits underneath everything and pushes it up and makes sure it's
right,
doesn't get noticed. And then even the engagement you were doing with sort of the early pre and then into internet space, mm-hmm. is you're not supposed to notice us, like,
yeah,
we're just
yeah.
here making this better than it was before without right. being seen.
Uh-huh.
And that's the same thing here. You're not really like the face of Clockwork, and you're not getting in Clockwork itself it's about the clients and not about us.
Yeah.
Like, is that just do you think you were taught some sort of early lesson of do good work and then stay out of the way and not make, I mean, there's a make it about me culture
yeah.
in the world and in the US certainly,
uh-huh.
and some of it's age, but not all of it.
Uh-huh.
So why don't you want more sexy attention, Chuck?
Yeah. This kind of goes back to playing in a band,
mm-hmm.
so my instrument was bass,
mm-hmm.
and
that's perfect.
Exactly,
all of this is just
it's all fitting together, right?
Yep.
So, and I like to hang out back by the drum kit in the shadow,
uh-huh.
in front of my giant amp, which like would rattle my bones, right?
How's your hearing?
Huh?
Such an obvious joke. I'm very happy it happened.
Right. But there was the beauty of that, and what I got out of that was there's the experience of being a part of something bigger.
Mm.
and feeling like in the band, when the band was really clicking and we're playing a great show and there's people and they're, you know, enjoying it, was like the energy from that was fantastic. Did I want to actually walk out to the edge of the stage and do a bass solo? Hell no. Did I even want to go up to the microphone?
I hope this isn't hurtful, but no one wants a bass solo. I think everyone should tell bass players.
Right, right. Well, then I did my job.
Yeah, you're a hero.
I never went up there and did a bass solo, ever. But I like being a part of it, but I didn't want to be seen. Hmm. And that's my same role here at Clockwork. Like, I'm so glad that Nancy and Megan have the personalities that they have to lead this business the way they do, because I'm the bass player here. I'm back in my office with the others, with the rest of the rhythm section.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's my thing. You know,
that's...
I can still feel the power of it. I can still feel the energy and the whole excitement of it. But, you know, like, I'm in the shadows.
That feels like a book. Mm. Like, just not, you wouldn't do it because you don't want that kind of
attention.
That's
right, that's right.
But, like...
I could write fiction about somebody else.
Because I played like football in high school, mm-hmm. and then was like, wait a minute, I don't like sports. Uh-huh. But I was a lineman, and the thing I actually liked about it is the linemen are integral to everything that's happening in a football game, uh-huh. but no one cares about them at all. Like,
yeah.
it's, you know, you have to be there for every single play, and you have to show up, and you have to do an amazing job.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do the best game of your life, probably one of your teammates is going to get an award. Not mm-hmm. you.
Yeah.
And I like that a lot. Uh-huh. But I also like clearly crave attention in my own ways. Like, I want some public applause.
Uh-huh.
So I think that's why I'm like fascinated by, you have a bunch of like nice big ticket successes. Like, you mm-hmm. can just, you know, like, you worked on some of the greatest albums arguably of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you weren't like producing, mixing the sound, except
yeah.
like alone when no one was around.
Right, right.
That is like a thing you could dine out on all the time, and I feel like you never lead with those stories.
Uh-huh.
So I guess I'm just explaining why that's fascinating to me. That it feels atypical somehow.
Does anybody ever flip the conversation around?
Oh, sure, yeah. And then I have to decide if I want to enjoy that or if I want to pretend that I'm
yeah.
not interested in talking about myself.
Uh-huh.
So who doesn't like talking about themselves, really? But no, what I am curious about, because you're a dad and you have three girls.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you, I mean, they're old enough, you know, you have like tween into high school age kids.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like, you kind of get a sense of their personalities at that point.
Yeah.
Like, you know who they are. And I wonder if you feel like you're modeling some do good work and stay out of the way kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Or what, how, or is that translating to fatherhood for you as well?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I mean, my kids love coming here.
Mm-hmm.
It's very family friendly.
You have lots of snacks.
Oh, the candy drawer. They love the candy drawer. We can bring the dog if
yeah.
you want. And I think they're, the older ones anyway, are kind of aware of what I do, but I still don't think they really know what I do. Like, if one of their friend's parents said, "What does your dad do?"
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they would be able to answer that question. But I think that they understand sort of the general concept of what Clockwork does. And, you know, when they're talking about careers now, they both have expressed interest in, like, interior design and space design. When my mom moved from her house to a condo, she was really nervous about, how am I going to fit my furniture in here? And the kids went and did the, name's escaping me now. What's the
there's building, an online
building,
tool
building
can...
block games? That,
yeah,
Minecraft.
They
basically modeled her new apartment in Minecraft.
That's amazing.
Helped her.
What a
rearrange.
Great application.
So that's good. You know, like, I think there's, and we've encouraged them to play music and explore the arts, and they're, you know, kind of in and out of that stuff. So
yeah.
But I think vibe-wise, I mean, I think they're following suit of kind of, they know that they want to find a job that is satisfying to them.
Mm.
And they want to find the classes in school that are satisfying to them and not the easiest stuff, but stuff that's actually interesting.
So it's that, do you think it applies at home of do good work and have a good life?
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, that's a good ethos.
Uh-huh.
Just because you said the phrase, I wonder, He said, "Yeah, I don't know if they can say what I do."
Uh huh.
Do you remember how you would have answered that for yourself? Like, what do your parents do mm-hmm. when you were young? Like, was it clean, simple answers of like firefighter?
My dad was a teacher.
Oh, that's not so perfect.
Yeah, it was easy.
Yeah, and was your mom, was she at home or was she?
She was at home with six kids.
Yeah, I imagine that's mm-hmm. so many children.
Yeah.
What did your dad teach?
He was a high school physical education teacher.
Oh.
And here's funny too, so my dad was a total, absolute 100% jock.
Mm-hmm.
And all of his kids were rock and roll, pot smoking, non-jocks.
Yeah. So now do you have three jock daughters? Like, does it flip back around?
TBD.
Yeah.
No, I don't think they're jocks. One of them's on the Nordic ski team. One of them plays basketball.
Yeah.
The little one does whatever is fun.
Well, I read a little. You have like a your outdoor sports enthusiast. Or mm-hmm. is that
the
most boring way to describe?
Here I picked another sport that's my passion, which is cycling.
Which is
another one of those, like, who gives a shit about cycling? Like, nobody is ever going to care.
It's true. And they don't want you to bring it up at parties.
No, don't talk about it, and certainly don't show up in those shorts.
Please don't, with or without the butt pad. Either.
Right.
Either is a great look.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't feel like a top layer for public.
Exactly.
Part of the work you've in your work history is a lot of like solo stuff, like the actual doing design work.
Mm-hmm.
It's like sitting alone with paper or sitting alone with the computer.
Yeah,
and that both like graphic design pre-computer and then now with computer.
Mm-hmm.
But now your job is heavily people oriented. It's very collaborative.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have the need to have time to be alone and in your head? And how does that balance out with
absolutely.
Your life that you is know, full I, of people?
Yeah. Today is one of those days I looked at my calendar and you know, just my whole body tightened up mm-hmm. because I need blocks of time. And so before you showed up today, I was, you know, messaging people like, can we cancel that meeting later today? I could really use some head count time. So it's very different.
Yeah.
But again, I think just the people here are, it's comfortable. I'm not good with groups of people, more than a couple people at a time. If it's like one-on-one conversation, you and I, that's great. If it's a few people that I know fairly well, that's pretty great. If there's a larger group of people, even if it's people I know well, I don't function mm-hmm. very well. So I think I just structure things to work for me, which seems to work for everybody else. We're a bunch of introvert weirdos here.
You're kidding. At a tech-focused company?
Right, right.
That doesn't fit stereotypes at all. Just everyone wearing glasses and beanies.
Uh-huh.
Like, I don't know what else.
Yeah. We actually have a beanie bin here, so grab your beanie.
There's an area that I'm curious about in that. You know, when you were first doing what like was amounted to coding, it wasn't codified. Like you were writing things that there were no rules.
Yeah.
And you mentioned like bringing in people to work with who were better at it than you.
Yeah.
But a thing happens or can happen where there are more and more rules of this is the right way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then people stop innovating or taking risks mm-hmm. because there's this right way to do it. Do you have ways of making sure you keep trying to stay out of that?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very Prince thing too. Of, oh, this album sells great, and this is how a song works. Like I'm sure that as an artist who knew exactly how to make a charting song mm-hmm. that would get played on the radio and would crush,
right.
and had to decide, okay, I know that, but what do I do with that information? Do mm-hmm. I keep making those, or do I just make some like?
Mm-hmm.
Is that present in your mind of wanting to make sure you're not just staying with like, okay, we have a good formula, we know what our client wants, so let's mm-hmm. do exactly the thing we've done that this kind of client has wanted before versus we're going to work with them and it maybe won't be that same thing.
Right. That's tricky, and that's something that whether it's on our mind or not is a factor in everything we do here mm-hmm. because you have to, you know, weigh and measure like what can we do here? What's in the budget? What's in the tolerance of the client? Ultimately, what we're always doing is thinking what is in the best interest of our clients, mm-hmm. customers, and users. So we are known for having a very well thought out, tested process that we call the elastic process. And it's taken us years and years, and it will never be done. You know, like, it's always evolving. But what we ran into was when we tried to get too process-focused, then we realized that we were turning into box checkers. And that wasn't serving us or our clients very well. So then we kind of swung back. This is where the elastic part came
in.
And ultimately where we landed is the elastic process is really a process that can be tailored to every single task or project or, you know, problem that we're looking at trying to work through or solve. It's still very difficult, the main thing, do great work, have great lives, is that we have to do great work, and we have to, like, do it within the budgets and get the money that we're owed and not spent, you know. So the biggest challenge there is that when we have these grand ideas to go push the boundaries, can we afford to do that, both for our own sake and for our clients' sake? Mm-hmm. So there's just kind of a balance that has to be struck there. I think there's been times where we felt like, we really have to start pushing it again. We're sort of getting stuck in this process mode, and then mm-hmm. other times when we're like, woo, and then we're like, holy crap, we went way over budget and our hourly rate is half of what it should be, mm-hmm. you know, at the end of the project. So
it sounds like that process itself has to go through its own elastic mode process,
right,
over and over, like, uh-huh. reiterating of, is this working? Let's check it by putting it through its own system.
Exactly. That's why it's always evolving.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That can be hard to live, like that idea. I think people like the idea of checking in all the time, but mm-hmm. then a lot of folks don't actually put that into practice.
Uh-huh.
Is it your job to keep the accountability that you're still doing that, or is it you guys all kind of check in with each other? Like, how does that actually
work? Yeah, I think, you know, I'm not that involved in the actual, like, you know, project side of the business anymore. So, you know, we have to think of that with our own projects and the other people that are involved in marketing and sales, and mm-hmm. and then just the, you know, the building stuff that I'm in charge of here. But we've got processes with marketing, but marketing for us is pretty new. You know, we are, for the first 12 years or so, like, our marketing was our reputation.
Yeah, word of mouth.
Uh-huh. And it still is, but a couple of years ago we realized that if we want to continue to grow and expand, we have to actually do something here. So, and I don't have a marketing, here's another insecurity part.
Go on. So, let's list them.
So, it's all like, that's my middle name.
Well, that would be a really mean middle name.
It would be, yeah.
We call him Insecurity. We don't want him to get too comfortable.
Charles Insecurity Hermé.
Ooh.
Yeah. So at that time, we decided, all right, we need to put focus on marketing here. Mm. And, you know, I raised my hand. It's close to, there's design elements and creative elements, like project creative in marketing, and it felt really good to me, but I don't have any marketing experience, really. I didn't go to school for marketing. I didn't have a job as a marketer at an agency. But what that's allowed us to do, I think, which can be a pro or a con, is that we're trying stuff all the time, and it either succeeds or fails. And I'm sure there would be some marketers that would be thinking, what the hell did you do that for? You know, that's a proven, it's proven to fail, you know, but we're still trying it.
Yeah.
And learning our own way. And I think that's exciting and breaks down the barriers a bit of lets us think a little freer than maybe we would if we were, like, educated, experienced, like.
Well, that seems like your MO, too.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't have the exact right background for this. I guess I'll do this.
Yeah.
Like that. Uh-huh. You can find yourself in those settings.
Yeah.
We've been talking a little while, so maybe it's sort of towards the close. The sort of other area I'm curious about is, I know Clockwork has a pretty overt now component of justice, of mm-hmm. Being a member of the community in that sort of meaningful way of, we're going to speak up when something's inappropriate. And it's not just about ethics and integrity in your exact field, but in general. So I know there's a leadership role in, like, making sure tech is pushing for equity because there are gender and race and ethnic gaps and mm-hmm. sort of just outsized difference And so I'm curious how you think about that as part of your work and your mm-hmm. role with kind of working internally with the staff, because mm-hmm. that can be really challenging to navigate. Mm-hmm. People who are really excited about that part of being able to be more vocal with what they care about in their work lives.
Yeah.
And then other people who are like, do we have to talk about this? I just want to go to work and not have to, mm-hmm. you know, give my take on whatever's happening in the world. And then it does fold into the marketing piece too, because there can be that fear of, if we stand up for this thing that is true and just and right, mm-hmm. are we going to put off clients who maybe don't even disagree, but just don't like the optics of it?
Yeah.
So how do you think about that, and how is it informed by your own sort of personal values?
Yeah, I think it's all just kind of been driven by instinct from the start. So, you know, I just met with a friend who is with a government agency now, who's having a lot of trouble with their work culture. And this friend Dana had just asked, like, can you just tell me about your culture and kind of how you got to where you are? And as we were having our conversation about that, you know, it became apparent to me that, like, trying to change a work culture is very different than growing one from that seed that I mentioned earlier. So I think what's happened is that the people that we've hired have really been a good fit in many ways. And you know, we can't legally, and we never would, ask those questions in interviews, right? But I think that people...
Will you stand in the fight against oppression?
Yeah, right, right.
I thought this was about coding.
I used to ask the question just as a joke in interviews years ago, like, Beatles or Stones?
Oh, that's tough.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I would fail your test.
I mean, now with, you know, I'm an old guy now, so if I ask that question now, a lot of these people would be like, what? The who or the what?
Yeah, you have to mention bands you know are deeply influenced by them. That's the way you get at
right,
that.
Right, yeah. But we've never really talked about it. We've never asked, until recently, you know, Nancy just, just a few weeks ago, before the Women's March, she said, how do you feel about this? Like, because I'm about to get up there and, like, this is no secret anymore, yeah. like, where we stand on this issue.
Well, she was already on the President's Council
yeah.
for families and...
Right. But, you know, the answer to that question was, like, well, of course you should do it. You
yeah.
know, there's no question. Like, I don't think anybody here would question that. And, you know, we're not pushing any agenda on the people that work here. We hope that they just are good people. Like, I live by the golden rule, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not a churchgoer. I'm not a Christian. I'm not, you know, I'm not really anything there. Here we go again. I'm the bass player.
You're just keeping time in the back.
Right, right. And just trying to do what's right. I think that's what is at the core of all of us here. And that was from the start of just, we're just trying to do what's right and be good to people, and hope people are good to us in return. So, you know, I think taking the risks and standing out and standing up for the things that we believe in politically right now, we can't not do that. And if that's offensive to people, you know, nobody has brought, I haven't seen anybody leave, nobody's brought things up. It's sort of the don't ask, don't tell policy too, of like, if I have a, you know, if I feel like maybe there's differing opinions on things, we're open to conversations with people, but we're not certainly going to go, you are wrong, pal.
Yeah. That idea that it's much easier if you grow it mm-hmm. than to change it, because I've been in both worlds, so.
Yeah.
Oh, this is a place has been made this way intentionally and it works.
Yeah.
And oh, this is a place that has been made in a way that's not great and they're trying to, but
right.
I think your planting a seed metaphor is apt, because if you plant tomatoes, there's almost nothing you can do to make it grow strawberries.
Right, exactly.
you got to dig out the uh-huh. roots and replant
yeah.
in that.
Yeah. And occasionally, you know, the weed gets thrown into the batch.
Yeah.
Then the weeds get weeded and...
Yeah. Let's keep the plant metaphors going.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the rains come and the sun.
Uh-huh.
And there's worms in there somewhere.
Yeah, that's right.
And like the they seem gross, but they're really helping.
Ecosystem, man. It's a beautiful thing. But, you know, we've got five values. And we'd lived these values for years. And we didn't write them down until 2 years ago. Mm. We just thought that everybody knew what these values were. And through part of the process of kind of metamorphosis of...
Can you rattle them off? I'm curious.
I hope so, because now I'm on the spot.
Okay, if you don't...
That would be really funny.
I'll edit it in later, where it's me doing your voice. Or you send me a voicemail.
Yeah. We tell the truth, keep our promises, so that's one, just being honest. We're fueled by challenge. So, meaning that we're just willing to take on things that are outside of our comfort zone and fueled by those things. We're smart. So that not only means like intellectually smart, it's less that, it's about we know how to work smart and we know how to work with people and get things done in a smart, efficient way. How many is that?
Three?
Four.
Four?
Three.
Oh, four maybe. I don't know.
The last one's the big one, which is nice. And that is, sounds simple, but, you know, we hire and fire by these, by these values. And, you know, you can look at any individual here and look at these five values and go, do they fit? And like, does that person fit? And it's been really successful of just gauging, like, and we even use the hiring process now when we have hiring committees. And really, at the end of it, when it's time to decide, like, do we make an offer to this person or not, it's really going through those values and saying, are there checks by each of these? Because if not, then we probably should pass on this person.
And you can have several people who hit all those and then dig deeper. Uh-huh. But that's a baseline. Yeah. I like that a lot. Uh-huh. And it's nice to have a filter to run those things through, too.
Right. And like you said, that is the baseline. That's just getting the right culture fit, the right type of person in here. And then from there, you know... It's
Beatles or Stones.
Right.
That's the secret sixth value.
That's right.
Is there a right answer? I mean, I know you came up Stones with your brothers.
Yeah, no, there wouldn't be a right answer. But if they said about, like, the Osmonds or something, then, you know.
And what if they made it, like, a really compelling argument? I mean, that'd be impressive.
Yeah.
You want them on your marketing team if they can sell you the Osmonds.
Right. You know, it's the Bee Gees. That's the one.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Where can I send people if they want to hook into your work or connect you directly for any number of whatever those things might be? What's the best way to reach out to you?
To reach me personally?
Yeah. And Clockwork, too, but...
Yeah. I'm just chuck@clockwork.com.
Mm-hmm.
That's the easiest way.
And is it just clockwork.com? Is that the website for all your Clockwork needs?
For all the Clockwork stuff.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Well, Chuck, I really appreciate you talking to me.
And thanks for coming over.
Yeah.
Well, here we are again. It's always such a pleasure. Remember when you tried to kill me twice? And how we laughed and laughed, except I wasn't laughing under the circumstance.